Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
It's Thursday night. It's 29 and a bit minutes past 7. It's May the 25th, 1978. And I, Al Needham, and my compatriots Taylor Parks and Neil Kulkarni are loving the polyester look of this episode of Top of the Pops. Hey up, you pop-crazed youngsters. Welcome back to part 3 of episode 54 of Chart Music. Let's not fanny about. Let's rejoin the episode in progress.
I must decide how to go. Is she mine? I want to know.
If you think long, you think wrong. So don't think too long.
Sound, isn't it? Heatwave, mind-blowing decisions. As if you didn't know it, Isaac Cohen and Alpha Beta won the Eurovision Song Contest with a number called Arbonne. You knew that already, didn't you? But right now, they're at number 21 in the top 30 at the moment. And here they are right now with you on Top of the Pops.
Blackburn, alone in front of a wash of colour, tells us, in case we didn't know, that the next single won this year's Eurovision Song Contest. Then he fucks up the title, calling it Avani V. Hopefully that isn't something offensive in Hebrew. It's actually Avani B by Izar Cohen and Alpha Beta. Born in Tel Aviv in 1951, Izar Cohen was part of a family of musicians and spent much of his youth in his dad's band. In 1970, he did his Israeli national service and honed his musical skills in the Lahakat Hahanal, the Ensor of the Israeli army. In 1978, he teamed up with the singing group Alpha Beta for Israel Song for Europe with this song, which was picked out to represent the country after the head of their Eurovision committee stated openly that it was the only entry that wasn't cat shit. And last month, in Paris, it became the first Eurovision winner from outside Europe, winning by 32 points and battering Baccarat, who were representing Luxembourg, and Cheryl Baker, who was in Coco. In the wake of that Eurovision win, an English version of the song was recorded, put out on Polydor, entered the charts at number 27 a fortnight ago, and this week it's up 5 places from number 26 to number 21. Well, chaps, more Euro nonsense here.
Yeah.
1978, another year of controversy in Eurovision land, unfortunately. The rule that everybody had to perform in their native language had been put back in place, which so enraged Björn Skifs of Sweden that he planned to sing it in English on the night, and then he changed his mind on stage, forgot the Swedish lyrics, and bust it with some gibberish. That we wouldn't have known anyway.
Yes.
More importantly, of course, when it became clear that Israel were going to win, most of the Arabic stations who were broadcasting the contest pulled the plug, with Jordanian TV showing a picture of some daffodils to fill the time, and Jordanian Terry Wogan announcing that the second place country, Belgium, had actually won. If there's any Jordanian listeners out there, I'm sorry to break the news to you. Oh, and of course, Jahn Teigen of Norway, the most memorable performance. He got the first ever nul point with Mille et un Mille, which is a tune.
It is, in that it has notes in it.
Yes.
I mean, this is obviously, you know, lower than TK Disco. Yeah, this is SJ Disco. This is barely even a fairground ring toss prize. I would rather have had a goldfish with 3 days to live, or a mirror with Starsky and Hutch on it, or a soft toy that's too big to carry around the fairground for the rest of the night. But it is catchy.
Yes, it really is.
That main hook is just insistent enough to get you, which is usually enough for a competition where the struggle is to remember anything you've just heard.
Yes,
you know.
Definitely.
Also, it stands out in the lineup of turkeys that was the Eurovision Song Contest 1978, because it's the only one that sounds faintly exotic. It's not Schlager and it's not chanson. It's got roots, albeit distant roots, in Jewish music. And that's enough to make it stand out, sound a little bit more interesting. A bit of sort of Middle Eastern flavour in a 2 hour banquet of mayonnaise. It's Zum Galli Galli with its flares on, looking for love.
Yes.
You know, work on the land by day, boogie by night. And it is better than the fucking Swiss entry, I'll give it that.
The Hebrew version of the song, of course, was aired on Top of the Pops a fortnight ago, but we're being treated to the English one here. But the lyrics are entirely different. The version we're getting here is essentially saying, love is skill, but the original is fucking dark as fuck. When we were children, we would love in secret. Who were we nice to? Only uncles and aunts. And the poor girls suffered. Those sweethearts, they'd just get beaten up. And what we really felt, we whispered in the Bet language. Because a Barney B is essentially, I love you in the Hebrew version of Pig Latin.
Right,
right.
And not, I want to be a polar bear, as some people thought it was.
Christ, that is bleak.
Yes.
It might as well have ended with the line, you know, at least this winter we eat. Or something like that. Jesus. Although it is really fucking catchy. It's catchy without being nursery rhyme-ish, which is a good trick for a Eurovision song. And the lead singer, I mean, he's just a magnificent stallion of a man with a magnificent mane. He's really captivating.
Yeah. Taylor, here's another addition to your band Chirpy Human Cerberus, isn't it?
Yeah, he is a bit, yeah.
It's ours here. It's a Uber Keegan.
Yeah, it is.
I wish I'd known about all these Eurovision shenanigans, though, because Eurovision just was not a thing for me.
Oh, it was for me.
In 78. I think Eurovision becomes a thing for me much later with Bucks Fizz. And I was aware of Brotherhood of Man, but only really via Top of the Pops in the chart. But Bucks Fizz, that was the first Eurovision I remember watching where I wanted the UK to win, and I was really glad that they did.
Yeah.
Eurovision before that, at this period, maybe it was just on too late.
Yeah, that's the thing for me, because Eurovision was really important in my life, because it was one of the few Saturday nights where I was allowed to stay up until almost 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah, midnight Central European time. All right, look, I've got to be honest. I did my bit. I went and watched the 1978 Eurovision Song Contest.
Well done, yes!
From Paris, with Serge Gainsbourg in the audience.
Wow.
Although, you know, he always looked half asleep anyway. And it is a strange affair.
Did he say, I want to fuck Angela Ripper?
I want to fuck Leon Zitron, the presenter of this, who speaks perfect English with a Swedish accent, even though he's French. But it was a strange affair all round. Like, late 70s France is a funny place anyway. Like, a lot of tired-looking men in flared suits smoking fags in the rain. Everyone's a bit too used to the taste of £5 wine. And has no energy left to philosophize. They just wear a wear a cream Macintosh while raising one eyebrow and their mouth hanging open. Then make yet another film about a bourgeois housewife who becomes a prostitute and likes it. How many of those films are they going to make? But it's, look, it's all on YouTube in English. So you get the benefit of Wogan and his twinkly Irish wit. Like the introductory film, they've got some scenes of Paris in it. And when Notre Dame comes on, he says, "The bells, the bells." It's a good one, Terry. Then they show a shot of the moon, and he says, "It may well be a French moon, but I'm not taking any chances. By gum, it is." What? See, that's how you earn the big bucks.
He's not bitter Wogan here, is he?
No, he's...
By this point.
He's just...
Mm. You know, later on in his Eurovision career, he'd start off all twinkly, then as soon as the votes came in and it was obvious we weren't going to win again, he'd get really bitter.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
It's like, Terry, you're Irish.
Yeah, precisely. No, he's... On this one, he's just enjoying du vin and he's pretty chilled. I don't think he's really that bothered.
No.
It's like he was trained into being bothered by this. And at this point, he's on a jolly, you know. And it's pretty much what you'd expect from 1978. All the male singers are in bell bottoms, like flares at the bottom, but so tight at the top, they're all bunched up around their doubtless bright red briefs, you know. Empty seats in the theatre with all the house lights way up high. Because it's still in that period. This is the thing. The golden age of Eurovision for us was that early 80s period where it became like an entertainment occasion. Like it was presented like a proper TV show. Whereas here, it's still in that period where it was treated almost like a formal occasion. With this sort of strange self-assumed importance, like the Rotary Club or something, you know. Like rather than what it really, like a jeu sans frontière that thinks it's summit. But look, I took a brief note for each entry, if anyone's interested. So to save everyone the pain of watching it, I'll give you a summary. In order of appearance, Ireland, balding, bearded Dublin cowboy with mad staring eyes and legs akimbo. Norway, new wave trousers, very, very old wave, everything else. Italy, ragazzi e ragazze, that's Italian for guys and dolls. Finland, strange woman, half Nina Mishkoff, half B. Smith. Portugal, Gemini, a singing group led by a Scotsman who looks a little out of place. Meninos e meninas, that's Portuguese for guys and dolls. France, a greasy chanteur, Kelsa Priest, but too young to be convincing. And you know what they say, never send a boy to do a man's job.
No.
They'll only steal his bike. Spain, gleaming white suit, gleaming white teeth like Jürgen Klopp, but it's the 70s, so they look uncomfortable. Should have been disqualified for not entering Lost Punk Rockers.
Yes.
United Kingdom, Coco, described by Wogan as an attractive, eye-catching group. Including Cheryl Baker and some clowns in stamped-on paint box outfits. And it's a Stephanie DeSykes composition.
Yeah.
Jaw-droppingly obvious rewrite of Those Were the Days.
Yeah. Yes.
Switzerland, just no fun, like a night out in Zurich, sung by somebody's wife out of the Sweeney. Belgium, piano ballad from a smoothie who is like the bloke of about 50 in a soap who's the local playboy. Netherlands, conducted by Harry von Hoof. Unexpected permed lady teacher in a World Book Day Aladdin outfit flanked by two boys' town dancers who look suspiciously and unconvincingly butch. Like it's a small country, maybe they couldn't find any gay men. Turkey, dressed as a wrongly assembled jigsaw puzzle. I kekle ve kisla. That's Turkish for guys and dolls. Germany, disco schlager with electronic keyboard sounds, i.e. as Germany 1978, as you can fit into the Eurovision Song Contest. Streamlined and sexless. Monaco, not going to comment on this one because it's not a real country.
No.
Greece, lady dressed as Charlie Chaplin, sings a song about Charlie Chaplin that goes, Charlie Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin, but she looks like Lorraine Kelly. Denmark, multiple Rod Stewart strippograms singing something that's obviously meant to be funny, but it's in Danish, so it dies a bit. Luxembourg, Baccarat, the actual Baccarat,
yes.
Cheating, pathetic, yeah. What a fucking disgrace. Luxembourg should have been banned from the contest.
Sorry, you're a Spaniard.
Yeah, fielding an ineligible player, isn't it?
Yeah. Ringers.
And worse than that, the song is a rewrite of Yes, Sir, I Can Boogie.
No.
Lux familiar. Israel, this shit. Austria, the Grumbleweeds, if they weren't a comedy act. Sweden, well, Sweden think they're big shots now, right? After ABBA. As you say, this guy thinks he can buck the rules and... he's just some idiot in he's got feathered hair and an Osmond's outfit doing a proper song, and he looks away looking thoughtful in the instrumental. It's like David Soul, right? The only good thing about it is because it's in French, they're credited on screen as Suede. In the final reckoning is brilliant. There's no frills at all. It's just a still shot of the scoreboard while unseen foreigners solemnly intone scores down muffled phone lines. It sounds like a numbers station for about an hour. And occasional shots of the artistes sat around what looks like the all-night bar in an airport, you know, like usual. But there's something noble and beautifully simple about it. And it made me think this is what they should do with Europe generally. Basically, everyone votes, and at the end, whichever country wins takes over the whole of Europe for a year.
Yes.
It's better than a war, isn't it, right?
That means we get Holland for 2 years. I'd settle for that at the minute.
Yeah.
Defo.
I think that anyone who balks at this is an enemy of democracy, really.
Mm.
Let Andorra have its day.
Yes. But anyway, this performance, they're all in white and gold with, good to see, straight leg trousers. Israel's on trend.
Yeah.
But what the fuck's going on with the set?
It looks like they've got tape machines. You know, like how, like, Depeche Mode and stuff, and Echo and the Bunnymen used to have, like, machinery on stage.
Yeah, they look like Edwardian one-armed bandits, don't they?
And I love the lineup of Alpha Beta too. It's like there's just this overabundance of backing singers.
Yeah.
There's no need to have six people on stage.
Mm.
None of them playing an instrument or pretending to. Mm. They're just shuffling from side to side, clicking their fingers, singing along. They're all singing, but they're so far down in the mix. It's like they're on the other side of a hill. You can't hear them.
Yeah.
I do like the instrumental bit in this song, by the way, just because the backing dancers and singers... They do that thing of, things are going a bit crazy.
Yes.
And they kind of juggle their heads about, like, oh, what's going on?
I like that bit.
It's so catchy.
Yeah. So the following week, a Barney B nipped at one place to number 20, its highest position. The follow-up, Make a Little Love, failed to chart and he never troubled the UK chart ever again. In 1985, though, he represented Israel again in Eurovision, where Ole Ole finished fifth. And he now runs his own jewellery shop in Tel Aviv.
Bunny B and I actually spotted that one as the winner for the Eurovision Song Contest, believe it or not. This one was a big hit for John Denver. In fact, it went to number one. It's called Annie's Song. It's a beautiful new instrumental version out by James Galloway, which I want you to hear right now.
Blackburn points out that he knew that song was going to win Eurovision, actually, before fucking up another intro when he introduces Annie's Song by James Galloway. Not a good night for Tony.
It isn't. And actually, when he comes out of that Alpha Beta song, I think he says, believe it or not, that won the Eurovision Song Contest or something like that.
Yes.
Basically implying, yeah, you know, who's buying this foreign muck?
Born in Belfast in 1939, James Galway was the son of a flute player and shipyard worker father and a pianist and mill worker mother who took up his dad's instrument and joined a fife and drum corps at the age of 9. By the age of 11, he was a genuine prodigy, having won the junior, senior and open awards at the Belfast Flute Championships on the same day. And when he left school at the age of 14, he worked as an apprentice to a piano repairer. At 16, he studied the flute at the Royal College of Music, then at the Guildhall School of Music, and then finished his studies at the Paris Conservatoire. He would then spend the whole of the 60s and half of the 70s as an orchestral player with Sadler's Wells Opera, the London Symphony Orchestra, and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And in 1969, he became the principal flute of the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. However, in 1975, he went solo and signed to RCA. And this, the follow-up to Russian Love Song, which failed to chart in 1976, is of course a cover of the John Denver single, which got to number one for a week in October of 1974, in between Kung Fu Fighting, the Ramadan number one in 1974, and Sad Sweet Dreamer by Sweet Sensation, which, like Denver, he recorded for his current wife, who had the same name. It's just entered the chart this week at number 51, and here's the man with the golden flute in his biggest assignment yet, leading the Top of the Pops Orchestra. Here they are. We finally get to see them again.
Mm.
All on the best behaviour. All togged out.
Yeah.
Cans of what is party for, safely hidden away for a moment.
Yeah, and they're completely competent. There's no...
Yes.
There's no seeming drunkenness here. I mean, given that on previous chart musics, I've admitted that I loved the floral dance, you might think I might like this.
I was expecting it.
Well, no, but we do get that same dazzling radiance from Galway's flute as we did from the Brighouse and Rascal bands, you know, brass instruments. But this isn't jaunty and it's not happy. And in 78, I would have hated this. For very similar reasons, actually, that I hated, as we previously mentioned, the Waltons and Little House on the Prairie. It's too emotional. It's like it's like I couldn't stand for the longest time the last scene in The Incredible Hulk. Because it was just too sad. And this was a period where I remember, I mean, it's something my sister takes the piss out of me massively for, but I remember watching a kind of old version of Hunchback of Notre Dame at this time in 78, and I was quite young. It was the Charles Laughton version. And at the end, when he throws himself off the tower, I think he says, why, before he jumps. And I was inconfucking-soulable for you know, age. I was sobbing. I couldn't get over it. And Annie's song, you know, it's too emotional. It's a loathsome song for me. I don't like it. What can I compare? You know, there's something about tunes that as a kid, they can be too emotional. Chi Mai, the Morricone tune, that's another one that just traumatized me too much. Because I remember when that came out, I remember like one of my favorite records in my youth was, my favorite albums was Jeff Love Orchestra plays Great Western Themes, right? Because the Big Country tune and Gunfight the OK Corral were massive faves. And I remember noticing Morricone's voice in the credits for it. And Chi Mai just upset me too much. I was appalled that he was knocking out this tearful stuff. So this, although it looks like I should like it because I like things like the floral dance, no, it just reminds me of sadness. And it reminds me of fucking recorder lessons as well. at school, just 30 slobbery kids making a really shrill racket. And Galway, actually, Galway's one of those artists that we were bought albums by. You know, we'd get a Galway album for Christmas from somebody trying to westernize us, I guess. and you know, this one, I mean, it was the one that was most unfathomable to me, the Galway album, because it was all just dreary, slow shit like this. And, you know, looking at this and listening to it, I just wonder, because there is this thing about James Galway that he's, you know, he's just this not this flute demon, but he's, you know, there's something special about him. But what's special about him? What's special about the way he plays? Nothing. And I think that's probably...
Like he sets fire to it or plays it with his teeth or his nose. If he'd played it with his nose, that would have impressed me.
But there's nothing special about his tone. It's just, I don't know, it's just clear. And I guess that's why he's huge. He provides music to people who don't want any of the flim-flam of pop. They just want a nice tune. Mm. And it's, of course, the flim-flam that makes pop interesting. But as a kid, yes. I would simply have been annoyed by this about... I mean, for starters, it's not fast. So yeah. I just wouldn't have liked that.
Yeah.
I mean, Annie's song was a slight nick of a bit of Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, Second Movement. It says here on Wikipedia.
Citation needed.
Yes, but that tune also provided the theme tune to the Paul Hogan Show. So,
oh yeah,
a very, very valuable piece of work by Tchaikovsky there. Well done. And of course, this is one of his first public appearances since he was run over by a motorbike in Switzerland about 6 months ago and broke his left arm and both legs.
Really?
Yes.
He's looking well.
Yeah, I think the same bloke who was after Jazz Coleman in Iceland.
What a music lover. This is horrible, isn't it? This is really horrible. This florid prick. He's like, he's got John Denver trapped inside that flute, feeding him on dried piss and Pontefract cakes. But I know from this distance, we watch the old Top of the Popsies, and the more variety, the merrier. But yes. I sort of have to stand up for the kids of the day and say this is a fucking disgrace. And I don't like this song anyway, never have, because why would I, you know, or anyone? And on the rare occasions that I do hear it, I'm always confused that it doesn't open with the line, "You came on my pillow," like in the Monty Python version, which is not very funny. It's on their Contractual Obligation album, which is largely barrel scrapings. And they do this weak 10-second gag where it says, "And now John Denver being strangled." And he goes, "You came on my pillow." But John Denver heard about this and complained and made them take it off the album. The complete fucking bell end. So fuck him. But this version is at least an improvement on the original just by virtue of having removed half the song, i.e. the lyrics. Yes. And that's the better half of the song to have removed, because can you imagine if it was just him reading out the lyrics as a poem? "Come, let me love you. Let me give my life to you. Let me drown in your laughter. Let me die in your arms." Fucking hell, man. Get a fucking back, man.
As opposed to a plane.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the only problem is that he couldn't have removed the music as well and just sat there for 3 minutes in beautiful silence, just staring at his flute, being pestered by a fly.
It's a fucking chunky flute as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
he's well known for having a platinum flute from Japan that's worth 20 grand, but this one, it's a beefy fucking flute, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, he loves it.
And, you know, I'm watching this, and yes, like you, my 10-year-old self would be nipping downstairs to have a look in the cupboard to see if United bars have been invented yet.
Yeah.
But watching it now, I just started thinking, well, who would win a flute fight between James Galway and Ian Anderson?
Oh,
because, you know, Anderson's got the obvious height advantage, but, you know, I think Galway's flute would do some serious damage.
Yeah.
Yeah, and behind, though, yeah. Galway, I would not fuck with Galway. The only person who could beat Galway would be Tara Bentovin, the Sunday Morning Kids presenter. But this has a Darnerish thing to it as well. So it's yeah, get it off Top of the Pops. What a waste of time.
I am picturing the choreography of this flute fight looking like Luke Skywalker versus Darth Vader, right? Holding the flutes upright like that. But he loves it so much because it doubles as a marital aid. Like if he's too drunk to do his evil duty, he gets out some rubber bands and uses it as a splint. It's like what Arthur Negus used to do. Like, he didn't want to miss out on the Antiques Roadshow pussy bonanza. But he was past a certain age in the days before Viagra, so he'd strap it to a Queen Anne candlestick. Pewter. That's how he managed to father all those kids who went on to work with Ras Michael. Oh, fucking hell. Someone let me out of lockdown. This isn't healthy.
The thing is with records like this, though, that, like, variety is the spice, don't get me wrong.
Yes.
But records like this, there is an implied snottiness and snobbery about pop, not only in the people who are buying it, but I do just think, yeah, this, you know, that the people who bought this, this is proper music. Mm. And Galway himself, you know, I feel that there's a snobbery and a snottiness to this. It's not music that will coexist with the rest of the pop music. It's music that gets in the charts and kind of looks around at what else is in the charts and just feels, this isn't really, you know, this isn't proper music. This is proper music. And that includes the people who buy it. So a lot of instrumentals that get into the 70s charts are very much like that. For people who like, a proper tune simply played without any of the nonsense. Well, the nonsense is the nice stuff, you know.
It's for people who grade music on how much it is like the still surface of a lake, you know. Like as soon as anything happens, that's just spoilt it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? But as it is, like, however offensive this is to the ear, it's even more appalling to the eye. And there's no excuse, right? Because plenty of older, uglier people have been on Top of the Pops and made it cool in one way or another. You know, the issue is not that it's not just that he looks awful, it's that he's chosen to look like this, right? Because I can forgive him the nervous, confused look because he's probably not used to working with musicians of this caliber.
No.
But there's no excuse for thinking, oh, I've got to go on Top of the Pops, so I'll turn up looking like an unkempt loner, well known to the local police, like with a house you can't get into because it's crammed with like old free newspapers and bin bags full of his own shit. It's not appealing. It's not so much Annie's song as Megan's Law. He's got that look of the 1970s creep, like really down to a T. Do you know what I mean? He, like a teacher who's always sat on his own in the staff room, or the or a sales manager at Sunshine Desserts with a shotgun buried in his garden. But it's either way, it's not. It's that look of dark, tangled, shapeless beard over a velvet bow tie. And an open velvet dinner jacket, open to accommodate his protruding gut, stretching out the white ruffled shirt. And it's supposed to be classy, but it just suggests a reek of mothballs and body odour and something that he's dribbled into the beard and down the front of the shirt, caught in the ruffles. It's too much Chateau Margaux at the dinner dance, you know what I mean? The party hands and then still driving home despite being pissed. Full body hair, including ears and nose, and breath like a wheelie bin. It's fucking horrible. You want to get him off the screen and back into a dark wood banqueting hall with a suit of armour in the corner and cross swords mounted on the wall. And fly a fucking plane into it. He is the image of every slightly unpleasant man who ever stood too close to you when you were a kid.
Yeah, 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 defo. He's gross. That beard is fucking foul.
Yeah.
And you don't want to see this guy eating anything.
No.
Would you have a sandwich made by James Galway?
Fuck no. Fuck no. I mean, the thing is, I could make him a really nice sandwich.
Mm.
Like... And I'd have to run away before watching him eat it. Could you imagine? Oh, man. He's got egg caught in that beard. He's fucking foul.
I apologise to any woman listening to this called Annie, because you must have had this song thrown at you right through your life. Oh, dear me. So, the following week, Annie's song soared 24 places to number 27, eventually spending 2 weeks at number 3 in the first 2 weeks of July. The follow-up, Arioso, failed to chart and he never resurfaced in the singles chart again, but he went on to become a successful albums artist. He played with Pink Floyd at their 1990 performance of The Wall at Potsdamer Platz.
That was great.
Won an Oscar for the soundtrack of the Lord of the Rings trilogy and released a 71 CD box set 5 years ago. 71 CDs!
Christ.
Oh, and if I had the money, I know what two lads are getting for Christmas.
Beautiful
sound, isn't it? James Galway there and Annie Song, and Johnny Pearson and the Top of the Pops Orchestra looking absolutely immaculate tonight. Slight change in tempo at number 29. This is Thin Lizzy.
She's hot mediator, smooth like a radio you'll never see. See you later, no one dare disobey your opening.
Blackburn gives a shout out to Johnny Pearson and the TOTPO before taking us back to the rock with Rosalie by Thin Lizzy. Formed in Dublin in 1969 when Phil Lynott and Brian Downey left the band Orphanage to team up with Eric Bell and Eric Rixton, who was an original member of them, Thin Lizzy named themselves after a comic strip about a robot girl which appeared in the Dan Dare in the 50s. They were almost immediately signed to EMI for the one-shot single The Farmer, which only sold 283 copies, but they were picked up by Decca at the end of 1970 and relocated to London, where they recorded their self-titled debut LP, which also sold poorly, despite regular airplay from John Peel on Radio 1 and Kid Jensen on Radio Luxembourg. After dropping to a three-piece and marking time by teaming up with members from the band Elmer Fudd to record an LP of Deep Purple covers, they supported Slade and Susie Quattro on their UK tours, only to discover that Decca had released their cover of the 17th century folk song Whiskey in the Jar as a single behind their back. But after it got to number one in Ireland, it went all the way to number six in the UK in February of 1973, giving them their first Top of the Pops appearance. However, the year ended badly when Bell walked out of the band due to health issues and being fucked off with the music biz, and he was briefly replaced by Gary Moore, who left a few months later, and by the time their deal with Decca was up, they were reduced to a two-piece. After picking up two guitarists, Brian Robinson and Scott Gorham, and signing a new deal with Phonogram, they continued their run of six flop singles after Whiskey in the Jar, but in March of 1976 they put out their sixth LP, Jailbreak, and the lead-off single from it, The Boys Are Back in Town, went all the way to number six in July of that year. This single, billed as Rosalie / Cowgirl Song, is the lead cut from their next LP, which comes out next week, Live and Dangerous. It's a version of their 1975 single which failed to chart and was recorded at Hammersmith Odeon last year. It's also a cover of the 1972 Bob Seger track that was a whinge about Rosalie Tremblay, the music director of the Ontario radio station OKLW, who wasn't playing Seger's records at the time. But Lizzy have turned it into a song about a woman that Phil Lynott wants to cop off with. It entered the charts at number 45 a fortnight ago. A Top of the Pops appearance got it up to number 40. And this week it soared 11 places to number 29. And here's a repeat of their performance from 2 weeks thence. This confused the fuck out of me because it's a performance of a live single, but it's different to the version they released 3 years ago with the Cowgirl Song bit at the end. But this is the version I fucking want because the riff on that is mint.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, their recording for Top of the Pops is the only version of it available, unless, of course, you know better.
The recorded version, when they don't do it live and they do it in the studio, is a tight as fuck kind of Stonesy thing. But this is, it's rawer, it's better. And Phil barely has the breath to do it. But God, after Galway, fuck me. I practically, stood up and cheered when this came on. What a band Lizzy were. I fucking love Thin Lizzy. My daughter's got me heavily back into Thin Lizzy in recent months.
Good girl.
She has a lovely way of not caring about, she don't care about albums or discographies much. She's brilliant at finding those ace 5 quid triple CD comps in supermarkets. Ooh. And she found one, of Thin Lizzy, which is perfect because you basically get 40 odd songs without having to trawl through the discography. And Lizzy is just so wonderful. They were always around when I was a kid, just by dint of being popular, being Irish as well, had a big part of it in Coventry as well. But I think at that age, I don't think I would have appreciated what a great songwriter Phil Lynott truly is. And you know, that they remind me in a sense of Zeppelin in that their rhythm section is key, and it's the one part of Lizzie that never changes. It's always Brian Downey and Phil. And you know, he's one of the most underrated drummers ever, I'd say, Brian Downey. So they've just got this solidity of sound. Because they get bored of just doing rock music, Thin and Lizzy are always slipping away from it to a certain extent. They've got these mad songs like Mexican Girl and Randolph's Tango, but it's always like really, really convincing. You know, when Phil does Irish stuff, he does it really convincingly, you know, unlike anyone else. Mm. Things like Black Rose, I love. And he has this Mannix type thing of overstuffing lines with lyrics, but he always does it so brilliantly. His bass playing is always infectiously funky. The dry studio sound of rock in the 70s, there's barely anyone better doing it than Thin Lizzy. I think they've suffered a little bit by being characterized by the big hits, in a sense, like Jailbreak and Whiskey and, you know, Dancing in the Moonlight and things like that. But there's so much more of them. And already, for me, instantly, they are the best thing on this show by far, so far.
Yeah.
You know, so I love Thin Lizzy. And this performance, after Galway in particular, It's just glorious. Phil Lynott's imagination with his writing, with his songs. I actually think as well that as we're pushing towards the 80s, I know this is 78, but that whole period from here actually until the early 80s, with things like Waiting for an Alibi and Chinatown and Killer on the Loose and Trouble Boys and Hollywood, Lizzie go into the 80s really strong. Really, really strong. Yes. And they you know, they vaunt that period really, really well. And of course, at the time, I mean, I don't know whether this was like a nationwide thing, but it just seemed like in my life, everyone's mum fancied Phil Lynott.
Yes.
Fancied the fuck out of Phil Lynott, you know? I mean, and understandably, he's incredibly good looking and he looks so damn good in this performance.
Yes, he does. You know? Yeah. Just a white shirt, black leather or PVC trousers, straight
and
leg.
That massive thick guitar strap with all the studs on it. He looks fucking awesome. Beyond that, I mean, it's just the best bit of the show so far because I really love the audience in this bit. It's like a proper rock gig. There's not kids being commandeered around, and they've got the space at the front to dance, and all the girls look like Janine St. Hubbins, basically. You know, and all the blokes kind of look like Artie Fufkin. This is a real highlight for me of the episode so far. Fucking love Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
I mean, we do see the kids getting down, but again, there's that big gap at the front and centre that's dominated by the cameraman, which kind of, to me, made it look like the kids couldn't be arsed and they're all hanging over on the other end of the studio waiting for the next act.
Yeah, perhaps. But, I mean, what blazing stuff is coming off that stage? And you're right, it is difficult telling what's live, what's not. Phil's vocal's definitely live. Because he seems like really out of breath. And perhaps the guitar sound is too strong for it to be live because it's, you know, as a replacement for what we've just had a beardy cunt playing this horrible, soft, sappy shit music to this. I genuinely did get up out of my chair and just go, fucking yes.
Yes.
Which is, you know, what does he do? Yeah, totally.
I don't disagree with a single word of what Neil just said. The two things that I love the most about Thin Lizzy, firstly, they do that thing that's so difficult, which only a few rock groups ever managed, of speaking for people who don't have that much to say. Do you know what I mean? Like the Who did it, but in a different way. It's like you've got an audience of mostly young lads who didn't really know how they felt or how to express it. Until their favourite band sort of sang it back at them. And they didn't do it with social comment or tortured young man stuff, which is the usual way. No. They just did it with songs about life and love and lust and frustrations without a trace of the self-appointed spokesman bit, you know. It's just stuff that people could relate to. And all the better that these mostly white lads could suddenly relate to a black Irish guy more easily than they could relate to their own families. You know, that can only have done good. I think the reason why everybody's mum fancied him, he had that combination. He was like a tall black guy, but he had that Irish twinkliness about him as well. Yes, I think that combination was lethal for a lot of people, and particularly a lot of mums for some reason. Yeah, I don't know why. And the other thing I love about him is the way that they played, in that it was really hard rock, but with this balletic lightness of touch. Like, it's like 50 ton titanium robots, like skipping and somersaulting. There's that little trip you get in the backbeat, and just the neatness of everything, even through a haze of booze and God knows what. It's almost like a feminine touch, and it stops these records, which are to some extent celebrations of masculinity, sounding boorish or lumpen. You know, they're very dainty in their way, which makes no sense, but it's precisely what makes them so great. Their relationship with their own machismo was quite interesting. Do you know what I mean? Like, you had Scott Gorham, who looks like Rapunzel with a Les Paul.
Who to me was the most American-looking person I'd ever seen in 1978.
And then you get, like, the cover of the album Fighting, which is one of my favourite album titles ever, where it's just a picture of them in an alley trying to look hard, holding bits of lead piping, and the word fighting over and over again down the sides. But this is their appeal, that they were sort of laddish and leering and leery. But it was humorous enough with a light enough touch to be really charming.
Just to interject, with that light touch, because I mean, when I think about finding my way back on that album, the way Phil goes, fighting, it's like, it is humorous. You're not getting an attitude, they're not copping an attitude. It's just, really lovely and fluid.
Neil, can you do the early and the late albums? I only do the five middle albums, really. I've only got the five middle albums, from Fighting to Black Rose.
No, the early ones I don't bother with. The late ones I need to bother with, I suspect, because I've not got around to them. But the five middle ones are sweet as. But, I mean, the thing is, you know what you're saying about macho-ness? All you need to do to kind of realise how special it was, what Lizzie did, is listen to any cover of them. Because when I think of, like, Metallica's cover of Whiskey in the Jar is one of the most appalling things you will ever hear in your life. And Hetfield just doesn't get it, obviously, because he's a fucking thick bastard. Yeah. But he just does not get it, you know? And if you try and play Lizzie songs in that balls-to-the-wall, metal-y way, no, you're not getting it. There's a fluidity, there's a ripplingness to their music that I think virtually everyone who's ever copied them never gets.
Yeah. Yes. And also, it's that charm, that twinkly charm, that lets them get away with so much, because they were like the poet's laureate of it was acceptable in the 70s. You know what I mean? There's such a warm, benevolent feel comes off Thin Lizzy in a weird way, however loud and brutal they could be. Well, of course, you know, you look at their output, and it's loaded with really dubious stuff, things which have since fallen foul of shifting conceptions of where the safety cordon should go, you know, around sleaze. A concept which would have meant nothing to Thin Lizzy, because that was what it was to them. Like, the whole point was they were sleazy and naughty, you know, that was the thing that they did. But they get away with it, because I don't think a well-balanced person could actually object to any of it. It's just... There's just a lot which makes you go, you know what I mean? But it's it's so deeply set into their modus operandi and their sense of purpose, in a way, that it's just, there's always a bit of a wink behind it, you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah, but putting out Killer on the Loose while the Yorkshire Ring
is still about,
a bit much.
Yeah, they weren't living in the real world.
But a lot much.
They weren't living in the real world.
Yeah, and more often than not, Phil uses his songs. I mean, he puts characters in his songs. They're stories, a lot of his little songs. Something that was beyond a lot of the Heavy Rock Brigade at that time. You know, in a few years' time, this type of music is going to be colonised by a different type of band. But the fluidity and the gorgeousness of Lizzie's music, yeah, it's kind of kind of gets lost soon. But even in the 80s, even with big gated drums and 80s effects, it's the strength of, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this because I used to not give a fuck about songwriting. But obviously, it's important. And Phil's songwriting, he's a fucking genius. He's majorly underrated. And I think him and Brian Downey, it's one of the greatest rhythm sections ever. Those old Lizzie records need listening to again. I think they've been forgotten about to a certain extent in terms of they've been turned into those three or four big hits and people don't dig into them enough. They're ripe for rediscovery, Lizzie, I think.
Yeah, it's that subtlety to it. I mean, you wouldn't piss in a bottle and hurl it at Thin Lizzy. It doesn't. You're not inspired to do that by this music.
No.
And yeah, this performance is fucking great. Like, they don't do a lot. They just communicate that combination of charm and menace really well. And also that shiny, reflective scratch plate on Phil's bass creating absolute havoc under the studio lights, like flashing and flaring every time he holds it at a certain angle. It's like he's playing a lighthouse. And also, what's stuck in the headstock of his bass? Is it a fag? You know, people used to put a fag... People, like, it's not lit if it is, but you know, people used to put a lit fag in the headstock of their guitar or bass, which I've never understood, because a fag burns down in the time it takes to play, at least the time it took to play a song in the 70s, right? Especially if you've got a wind machine on stage. Look, there's a clip of Pink Floyd playing Dark Side of the Moon, and Roger Waters has got a fag burning away on his headstock, which is... surely the height of stupidity when you're playing a 40-minute song cycle. And it's like, just as it begins, I'll just like have one drag on it and just put it in there and it'd be all right.
No, do roll-ups. They tamp themselves out, don't they?
That's true.
Yeah. It doesn't look like a roll-up, though. It looks perfectly cylindrical.
Fucking idiot pop star.
Also, did we need to find out what the actual track... I did my research. I couldn't find out what we're actually listening to here. There is famously some debate over quite how live and dangerous really is.
Now,
I'm slightly cynical. So to me, it's about as authentically live as that Seeds album with the overdubbed screaming girls on it, if you've ever heard that. But I'm thinking, could this be... the track without the vocals and without the audience from Live at Dangerous? I haven't heard that album for about a year, so I can't remember.
I don't think it is. I think they've done it specially for Top of the Pops.
Yeah. In which case, whoever oversaw that session has done a very good job of capturing that very dry, powerful sound. Because it just sounds like Thin Lizzy, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like a Peel session or something. It sounds like Thin Lizzy. He's another West Bromwich birth, you know.
Is he?
Yeah, people always talk about living in Ireland and about his heritage. Born in West Bromwich. It's him, me, Robert Plant, Denise Lewis, Colin Jevons, Brian Walden, and Madeline Carroll out of the 39 Steps.
Brian Walden. Good Lord.
So the following week, Rosalie dropped 9 places to number 38, then soared 17 places to number 21, then dropped 11 places to number 32, then soared 12 places to number 20, its highest position. Why? Fuck knows. All I know is that the British Market Research Bureau had expanded the official chart from a top 50 to a top 75 in this month. And they abolished their system of excluding records that had dropped into the 41 to 50 slots in order to get some more new stuff in. But I don't know, it does make sense. There's one or two singles in this Top of the Pops that just bounce.
Mm.
Like that Matchbox thing with the ball bearings on the skins that I always wanted but never got. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I do
now.
That was fucking brilliant. I mean, I do know that the Daily Mirror launched an investigation against A&M Records about chart rigging. Elky Brooks and Peter Frampton, they got their stuff hyped up. So the British Market Research Bureau had a bit of a fiddle with the way they did things, and I don't know if it took a month or so to smooth everything out. But yeah, records bouncing up and down all over the show.
Elky Brooks and all her tampered books.
Yes.
Just roll me over. turn around and I move my fingers up and down. Look out!
I'm Mark Haynes, and for the last 32 years, I've been a fan of professional wrestling. My friend Pete Donaldson from the Football Ramble, he hasn't. But in our podcast, Wrestle Me, the two of us subject the greatest spectacle in sports entertainment, WrestleMania, to the kind of rigorous scrutiny that ruins it entirely. GQ called Wrestle Me enrapturing. Shortlist said it's beautiful. And it's a hit with common people too, with well over 400 five-star reviews on iTunes. Wrestle Me, available from all good podcast providers.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There it is. That's the number 29 sound here on Top of the Pops. The sound there of Thin Lizzy and Rose Lee. The Bee Gees writing some fantastic records at the moment, aren't they? And from the film Saturday Night Fever, here's Tavares and More Than a Woman, number 7 this week.
Blackburn, still socially distancing from the kids, wangs on about the songwriting ability of the Bee Gees as he introduces More Than a Woman by Tavares. Spawned by Mr. and Mrs. Tavares in Massachusetts and Rhode Island in the 1940s, the Tavares brothers began their career in 1959 as Chubby and the Turnpikes, before changing their name to Tavares in 1973 and immediately making dents upon the American charts, including their cover of She's Gone by Hall & Oates, which got to number one in the R&B charts in 1974, and It Only Takes a Minute Girl getting to number 10 on the Billboard chart in 1975. A year later, they made their first raid on the UK charts when Heaven Must Be Missing an Angel got to number 4 in August of 1976, kicking off a run of 5 top 40 hits and 2 top tenors with Don't Take Away the Music and Who Done It. This is the follow-up to The Ghost of Love, and is their contribution to the soundtrack of Saturday Night Fever, a cover of the Bee Gees track, which also features on the original soundtrack. And this week, it's moved up 6 places from number 13 to number 7. And here's a video. And quite an impressive video by 1978 standards, isn't it? Loads of split angles and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, we see various members of the band in different corners of the screen. And then, you know, the woman comes out and she demonstrates that, yes, she is more than a woman because there's 5 of her.
Yeah, and the band in bizarre outfits, and they're not the first soul band we've seen wearing them either. These things, they're like crimpine dungarees or overalls. It's like an all-in-one trousers and midriff cover. It's like a pair of trousers that comes up to the tits, you know, just flat across the stomach, like a breastplate. And it just, yeah, just stops just at the point where you can show off your wing-collared shirt and chunky tie. And they really are abominable. There's no buttons or zips or anything. It's just like an animal suit, like a like a stiff onesie. It's not even flattering to tall, well-built black men, which is really the test of bad tailoring. And I think it's the same outfits that we saw. Was it the Stylistics wearing in the chart rundown? It was just a picture of them on the chart rundown. Except, as if it wasn't bad enough, theirs were yellow. Like banana yellow, like Maplin's surplus. It was like it was the Web twins, Chris Andrews and the Stylistics.
This, of course, was used in the Rocky bit of Saturday Night Fever, wasn't it? Where Tony and Stephanie are working out the moves in the dance studio that was owned by the middle-aged pervert.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's got to be said that the Tavares version, once again, pisses all over the Bee Gees version.
Do you think so?
That they dance to at the end.
I don't know if it's better. It's different. Nothing at this time can be as perfect as a Bee Gees record. They're perfecting pop in a way that no one bar sort of Marauder or ABBA are doing at the moment. What saves this from being a knockoff or an inferior knockoff is the fact it's Tavares, who have amazing voices, who can actually bring something, you know, which sort of all Bee Gees songs need in a sense, something non-creepy to it, to a good song. The Bee Gees always had something creepy about them.
Yeah.
But it's different quality of voices. I dispute that it's kind of better than the Bee Gees version.
Well, I think it was a schoolboy error by John Travolta to pick the Bee Gees version to dance to in the competition instead of this. and no wonder Hector and his missus won a moral victory by doing KG. And Travolta was absolutely right to give him that big cup and the $500. He knew. And if Travolta knew, then I know as well.
Yeah, he didn't have to make such a show of it, though, did he? But, yeah, no, I think I slightly prefer the Bee Gees version. Just because, well, on If I Can't Have You, the more human approach brings more out of the song. Whereas on this one, I think it suits that sort of ghostly gliding, that relative lack of flesh and blood in the Bee Gees version suits the creepy, heavenly creepy feel of the song. Perhaps it comes down to the fact that the opening lines of this song are so Ed Stewpot Stewart-tastic that I'd rather hear them drifting in from a floating cloud than sung by a recognisable human being.
I mean, again, like the real thing before, Tavares are a soul group who've gone disco, but it's been a smoother transition for Tavares, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, what a run as well. It has to be said, what Tavares are on.
Yeah.
From 76 onwards. Amazing run of singles. But yeah, they seem to suit it better. It's the voices with disco that don't problematise it as such, but might make it sound like more of a soul or a funk thing. Because, I don't know, they're not heavily textured voices as such, and they're not overly processed voices. There's a soulness to the vocals, if you like, that could be from 1975, but the undertow of it is definitely disco, it's definitely Saturday Night Fever.
The film's been out for just over 2 months in the UK and is still packing them in. It's currently running alongside The Goodbye Girl, High Plains Drifter, The Wages of Fear, The Last Dinosaur, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Confessions of a Lusty Housewife, Camp on Blood Island, Plague of the Zombies, The New One-Armed Swordsman, and The Pawnbrokers, of course, spelt P-O-R-N.
Yeah, it's a good film.
One-Armed Swordsman's a blinding film.
Oh, yeah, it's a fucking great film.
But, I mean, this is the love theme from Saturday Night Fever, like the unconsummated love theme. And I think that those forced lingering gazes and embraces slightly undermine the song in a way, because if you're just listening to it, like the simplicity and let's face it, the banality of the lyrics doesn't matter. Whereas when it's an accompaniment to a very soft focus close-up of two faces gazing into each other's eyes, it becomes a bit too annoying.
Or spinning each other round.
Yeah. I had no patience with any of that.
No. I mean, Saturday Night Fever was a fucking weird vehicle to put John Travolta in, since they were trying to angle him as the latest heartthrob. It's like they're saying, hey, girls, come and see John Travolta be racist and violent. He's ever seditious. Oh, and you can't see it if you're under 18 because he tries to rape his love interest in a car and get kicked in the bollocks.
It was a real shock to me when I first watched Saturday Night Fever. It's such a bleak film.
Yes.
In lots and lots of ways. You know, and the dance sequences obviously then take on this kind of radiant hope that the rest of the film doesn't have. Mm. And I didn't know, of course, at the time that, you know, Nick Conn, one of my favourite writers, is what this is based on, one of his articles. But the bleakness of it is still quite startling to this day, because we all associate Saturday Night Fever with two things, the film and the look of John Travolta, but also, of course, that soundtrack LP. The soundtrack LP reveals none of the bleakness, in a sense, like from the front of it, or the participation of the Bee Gees in it. But the film, when you watch it, God, you don't come away from it dancing. You come away from it quite depressed.
Yes.
It's quite a depressing, bleak film, Saturday Night Fever. And I really do like it. I think it's a really good film with a fantastic soundtrack, but it's good because of its bleakness. I think if I'd have seen it at the time, it would have been really, really startling to me.
Yeah,
you're right, because when I was that age and there were films going about that I obviously couldn't see because I was too younger, I used to imagine what they'd be like. And I think I got Saturday Night Fever. It's a film about a bloke who's really into disco and he goes to discos all the time. And it's great. And he does nothing else but go to discos. And then at the end, he gets into that pose and he just goes, "Disco, yeah!" And that's the end of the film. And that would have satisfied me deeply as a 10-year-old.
Yeah, it's... Well, first of all, what's funny about Saturday Night Fever is, it's based on that what's it called? The Tribal Rites of the New Saturday Night, by Nick Cohn. And he knew nothing of disco or New York City. He had to write about it, and he just made it all up. Based on his own experiences of the mod scene in London.
Yeah, it's a mod film, isn't it? Saturday
Which
Night
is
Fever.
What? It's basically a slightly, very slightly more downbeat Quadrophenia. And yet this is the holy text of New York disco, this film and that piece of writing. For all we know, it could just be a pile of old mints, you know. But it's a great film, if just because there's so much fascinating stuff in it to gaze upon, like it's old New York and... Old freedoms and old miseries, and John Travolta's peculiar relationship with heterosexuality. And it's like a grand tribute to everything we can't do anymore, like being in big crowded rooms, you know, the thrill of the crowd. I don't mean that we can't do anymore because of the pandemic. I mean, just because we're old and fucked, you know. But there's a few things in it that great. Like the fact that, everyone in the whole film is basically awful. And I sort of like films like that, but I'm never 100% sure how awful you're meant to think they are. And also, how come this disco that they all go to is meant to be so cool when DJ's only got one record and it's the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever? It's not exactly deep cuts, is it, mate?
No.
And also, in the mod world that Nick Cohn understood, dancing had a different function psychologically. The point is you would disappear into the crowd and you'd either reach a kind of collective nirvana, like Acid House style, or you could stand out within the crowd in a sort of a weird kind of way. But the crowd was the thing. Whereas a lot of Saturday Night Fever is about... Or it's focused on this like narcissistic individual display of what dancing had become, like these dance competitions which you have to train for like an athlete. And that scene where Tony clears the floor so that everyone has to watch him, takes over the dance. This is the scene that makes me hate him, like more than all the more obviously terrible stuff he does. Fran Drescher comes up to him, right? Fran Drescher, who I've always massively fancied anyway, comes up to chat him up and says, "Hey, are you as good in bed as you are on the dance floor?" And they go off to dance and she's like really slutty and great. And but because she's not as good at dancing as he is, he's like, "Oh, fuck this." And he just ignores her. And just dances on his own and clears the whole floor. So everyone else has to watch this dance onanism. And he's like doing Cossack shit. And fucking idiot. It's supposed to be an expression of his existential confusion or something. I don't know. Where I come from, they call it being a dick.
Yeah.
It's an odd film to become such an international smash. But I think it's the film from 78. That exerts a bigger future influence than other big cultural behemoths of that year. Because, I mean, we'll come on, obviously, to talk about another massive film from the States this year that is a musical. But when you think of musicals after this year, there aren't any, really. There are none until, like, much later, much, much later. Whereas what Saturday Night Fever is, I guess you could call it a dancical. It's like, you know what I mean? It's dances soundtracked by music. But what you're watching is the dancing. You're not watching the singers singing it. But the music, you know, is part of the narrative thread of the movie. It's a dancical. And those films kept going. There were still plenty of those.
Oh, God, so, throughout the 80s.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, so I guess it exerted a much bigger influence than the other big American film of the year. But it's still startling just what a nasty piece of work it is in a way.
Yeah. And, of course, this is the film that codified disco, especially in the UK. You know, if you want to go to disco, you got to look like this, and your disco's supposed to have this kind of floor. And this is the music you play.
Yeah.
And this is the suit that Tony Blackburn wears.
This is why the Pink Panther does those moves at the end of the cartoon.
Mm.
Because of this film, they're all in here.
So the following week, More Than a Woman dropped one place to number 8 and then nipped back up to number 7 the next week, its highest position. The follow-up, Slow Train to Paradise, would only get to number 62, and they'd have to wait 8 years for their next sniff of the charty arse when a remix of Heaven Must Be Missing an Angel by Ben Librant got to number 12 in March of 1986. Say you'll always be my baby, we can make it shine.
That's a number 7 sound there from Tavares. It's called More Than a Woman. I think that's going to be my favourite, along with the Von Elliman this week. Right now, Never Say Die. That's the brand new one from Black Sabbath.
Tony, still malingering at the back of the studio, tells us that that song and Yvonne Elliman's are his favourite tunes in this episode, virtually implying that we might as well switch off right now. He then throws us at a band that presumably get very little time on his turntable at home, Black Sabbath with Never Say Die. Formed in Birmingham in 1968, the Polkatuck Blues Band immediately changed their name to Earth, but when they found out another band was already using that name, they scrabbled around for a new one. According to legend, they chanced upon their new name when the cinema across the road from their rehearsal studio started to advertise their next film, the 1963 Boris Karloff horror movie Black Sabbath. They wrote a song with that title, made it dead scary, and adopted it as their new band name. Just as well, Carry On Up the Khyber wasn't playing at the time, something like that. They signed to Philips Records at the end of 1969 and put out their debut single, a cover of Evil Woman by Crow, which failed to chart. But their debut LP, Black Sabbath, got to number 8 in the UK in May of 1970, and the immediate follow-up, Paranoid, got to number 1 in the LP charts in October of that year. And the title track was released as a single, getting them to number 4 in the same month. This single, the follow-up to Am I Going Insane, which was released in February of 1976 and failed to chart, and the title track of their next LP, is only the 6th single released by Sabbath in the UK. It came out last Friday and isn't in the charts yet, but as they're currently touring the UK, here they are, making only their 2nd appearance on Top of the Pops. Before we turn our attention to Sabbath, why is Tony being kept apart from the kids? Do you think the BBC are worried that he's taking his Travolta persona a bit too far and he's going to get girls up on stage and ask them, are you a nice girl or are you a cunt?
It is weird that it's very noticeable, very noticeable that there's no grinning girls or grinning boys next to him at any point.
Very strange. But anyway, this song, it's just as well that Thin Lizzy aren't in the studio this week, as I think their ears would be burning at the intro of this song. It does remind me very much of Boys Are Back in Town, don't you think?
A little bit, but I mean, you know, at this point, Thin Lizzy are together and solid. And at this point, Sabbath are just falling apart by this point.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, Neil, where are Black Sabbath in May of 1978, apart from standing over the prone Alan Jones and saying, leave it, Tony, he's not worth it?
The Sabbath are, I mean, they're about to kind of disappear for 4 years. Ozzy's already quit the band, but then been sort of rejoined in a sense. They're falling apart. Mm. Too much drugs, too much alcohol. And to be honest with you, with Sabbath, after the first two albums, drugs just exert such a colossally bad influence on the band in terms of their personal relationships that they're just massively, massively dysfunctional by this point. You know, and but despite all this, they could occasionally still be just fucking awesome, as this track shows. I mean, yes. I love it. I actually love this. This kind of period of Sabbath, with the Technical Ecstasy album that preceded Never Say Die and this Never Say Die album, they're often kind of, you know, the kind of biblical thing to say is, yeah, you know, you need the first three Stooges albums, you need the first seven Led Zepp records, and you need the first sort of six Sabbath albums. And I would still go along with that up to Sabotage. They are essential texts, if you like. But, you know, and it's often seen that Technical Ecstasy and this one are a mess because they're a great band falling apart fundamentally on both. But that's precisely what I like about it. There's a real Royal Trucks like ugliness to what they do in this period. Mm. And I like it always when Sabbath, in a sense, depart from that slow motion, heavy blueprint that they'd laid down. Mm. It's tracks where they start, I don't know, because they start using synths and stuff in this period. Mm. And it's always really jarring, but really sulfurous and nasty as well.
Yeah.
And what you're seeing in this period of Sabbath is really that their mutual animosity, because, like, you know, they hate each other really by this point. You know, they go to Toronto to record this LP in the middle of winter just because the Rolling Stones have recorded a really poor live LP in Toronto the year before. It's all a mess at this point, but their mutual animosity is finding its way into the music, not in a confrontational way, but it's like, you know how, like, you could be walking down a street and you'll see two kind of booze-addled guys threatening to bang each other out, and they will bang each other out, and then the next morning they're just, you know, next to each other, still friends. It's like that. That's what Sabbath are like at this point. They're really massively dysfunctional, but they're still pals in a sense because they've got nowhere else to go. And I you know, I would never say that this period is comparable to the early period, but there's pleasures to be had because you can always with Sabbath hear the character of the people involved, you know. Ozzy, the maniac with a kind of heart of gold, a real heart of gold. And that's key to Ozzy. He's not just scary or something.
He gave Neil a couple of boxes of tea bags.
He did give me a couple, but it's got nothing to do with that. But he's, you know, I mean, this is the thing with Sabbath. I'm not saying they're misunderstood as such, but they are different than the heavy metal that they supposedly birthed. Mm. You know, when I listen to heavy metal, there's a glory in evil to it. There's a delight in being satanic and all of that. Sabbath were never that band. You know, Geezer Butler, who writes a lot of the lyrics, is a terrified Catholic. That's why so much of their music, you know, Ozzy sounds genuinely scared of the devil, and also they're big Beatles fans, right? They're coming from a period in the 60s where they idolize and are obsessed with the Beatles, so that comes into their songwriting. You can hear that a little bit here. Of course, you've also got Bill Ward, the implacable rhythmic force of the band, who's just amazing on this track. The speed of what he's doing, that fast, I know. But
that's why he's had to take his shirt off.
No, he's just amazing. And of course, dominating in a sense the riffs, which are the heart of their music, is Tony Iommi, who's the boss and a kind of fucking really angry, scary one at that. So even though this would be seen, I guess, as a bad period for Sabbath, and you can kind of see that Ozzy's almost laughing his way through this performance, and they are about to fall apart completely, because they've kind of lost the will, really. They've lost the desire to go on with it. But and pretty soon, you know, Sabbath in the metal stakes, if you like, are going to be left behind by bands like Priest and Maiden, i.e. bands that could play and were disciplined, and this band were never really that disciplined. But this performance is great. I love Bill's look. He looks properly like he don't give a fuck.
Yeah. He looks like he runs a vape shop in Brighton.
He does. He looks startlingly modern, doesn't he?
Yes, very
I think
much
Bill
so.
Ward. He looks like, you know, you could see him in a band now.
Yeah.
He looks like he's disguised as that bloke who had the sign that said, "Get a brain, morons."
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He does. But also, they've got that lovely look with the boots that Ozzy's wearing and stuff. They've got that perfect kind of... This is where Spinal Tap comes from, to a certain extent, that look of both being a heavy rock band, but being very colourful and almost having a glam touch to it. But Never Say Die is commonly derided as an album, but I think it warrants reinvestigation precisely because of its ugliness and its depiction of a band falling apart, but still something happens when these four guys are in a room together that's special. And even in this Top of the Pops performance, you get that. You get that powerfully, I think.
Yeah,
I'd never heard this song before. And if you'd have played it to me without visuals and said, "Oh, this is from 1978, I'd go, "Oh, this is one of them this is one of them new wave of British heavy metal bands who are copping a lick off Sabbath."
Yeah, but what you don't get, you see, with Sabbath ever is any kind of twin guitar virtuosity.
No.
Or any of that kind of... You know, there's little fantasy in Sabbath's music. It's mainly depressing and dark, but also just shot through with a real sappy innocence and love that makes it really cherishable. I just think they're such a... Lizzy were one of the highlights of this show, and I think this is the sort of second big highlight for me.
Yeah, I always feel like it's almost like metal skipped a generation, or Sabbath skipped a generation. If you listen to like that new wave of British heavy metal stuff, it sounds more... like they grew up listening to Deep Purple and stuff like that, where there's almost like a progginess to it.
Yeah.
And it's like you hear Sabbath much more in more recent metal stuff, where it went back to the roots of, you know, of just sludge, you know, in the best possible sense. Yeah, I feel a sort of weird tribal, local cultural identification with Sabbath and understanding. I can't explain it, but there is some peculiar thread there, you know what I mean? It's like there's I'm dangling from it, and then somewhere along there's Ozzy and every other flat vowel chip munching subhuman from the workshop of the world, which is Birmingham, not to be confused with Worksop, which is the Birmingham of the world. But I do feel it, even though I didn't grow up a metal fan, but 3/4 of my middle school were obsessed, and Ozzy was a god. So I grew up hearing that music as a soundtrack, in the same way that I grew up with the charts as a soundtrack, right?
Yeah.
And even if I didn't necessarily like it all, I didn't necessarily like what was in the charts, I heard it. And, you know, in the same way that I would go back to the charts at the time when I was a little bit older and discover, actually, I did like much more of it than I thought at the time. Same thing happened with heavy rock. But that sense of local connection only happens with the Sabs, right? Not really with Duran Duran or Dexys or ELO or any of the other good groups to come out of Birmingham or the West Midlands. It's just Sabbath. I can't explain it. There's just something about the sort of wall-eyed, insistent misery of it. But good natured underneath, you know what I mean?
No, that's it, because whenever I've seen Ozzy live or Sabbath live, you know, with songs like this, I mean, like you said, like, you know, that first track, Black Sabbath, that they ever did is still properly a terrifying bit of music because of Ozzy's vocals and stuff. But whenever I've seen him do it live, or Ozzy doing it live, he doesn't get a pained expression on his face. He claps constantly when he plays. Like, he's all about getting the crowd going, you know what I mean? And there's that odd mix with Sabbath that, you know, definitely they could not have come from any other place. They could not have come from any other place than Birmingham. When you sit in certain parts of Birmingham, when you sit in a pub in Birmingham, for instance, and you look out the window and you just feel encased in concrete, like the concrete goes to the sky and you can't see a fucking lick of green anywhere. That's the Sabbath sound. And they could not have come from anywhere, regardless of whether Tony Iommi's, you know, industrial accident affected his riffing or whatever, because he had to have those bits of plastic on his fingers. They have to come from Birmingham. Definitive Brum band, I would say. And something that Birmingham are, in a good way, you know, proud of. I mean, where I work was opened by Tony Iommi, and although he's my least favourite Sabbath member, but
what, did you just punch it or something?
No, I wouldn't trust anyone who didn't like Sabbath in a way.
Yeah. That was the story when Alan Jones interviewed Ozzy a few years after Tony Iommi beat him up, and he said, oh yeah, last brush I had with a member of your band, he punched me in the face. And apparently Ozzy just shrugged and went, yeah, but that's Tony, fist for brains. I fucking love Ozzy. Love him so much. Yeah. And the more out of his nut he gets, like, the more lovable he is, you know. Mm. It's like the 11-year-old boys that I knew when I was 11 thought he was a god, but the whole point was that he wasn't a god or a devil, yeah, you know. Mm. And it's easy to forget, for years a lot of people seriously thought Ozzy was a devil worshipper. Even after he'd said the only black magic Sabbath ever got into was a box of chocolate. He was an awkward and slightly unhappy geek who transformed himself into magic without losing his identity as an awkward and unhappy geek. In fact, that was the key to the magic. But by this point here, he's more like the solo Ozzy, sort of wild-eyed and overdressed, you know. And if you prefer a genuine, real-life, alienated boozer giving you pure doom feeling direct, then the early Sabbath Ozzy is vastly preferable. But this one, I mean, at least he makes sure he gives you a show. There's something peculiarly heroic about him, although the other members of Black Sabbath at this time would have disagreed. He's not just an old pro, you know what I mean? It's like, that's the thing, he's no kind of pro at all. That's the problem. It's just, this is real. This is what he's communicating. He's incoherent and ludicrous and all over the place. And this song is, it's no Paranoid and it's no Killing Yourself to Live or any of these songs which mean something, where it's like he's singing from the heart. But it's still great because even in this state, he is a perfect vessel for communicating desperation in a pure and unselfconscious way. He's just this open channel. And, you know, who can gripe that nowadays that channel is closed and he's all showbiz? Because fucking hell, it nearly killed him.
Well, quite.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And at this point, I mean, he's already wearing T-shirts that say Blizzard of Oz on it. I'm not saying he's, you know, already conscious of the fact that he's going to be a solo star pretty soon. And solo Ozzy is different than Sabbath Ozzy.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's that voice. It's that pitiable whine that he's got. He's one of the all-time greats. And this band are one of the all-time greats. This is their kind of, like, this is where I depart company, because I'm not interested in Dio-era Sabbath or anything like that.
No.
Nobody should be. And the one thing that does piss me off about Sabbath is their later treatment of Bill Ward. But, so I'm quite doctrinaire about Sabbath. It is these first sort of 6, 7, 8 albums, but they're all fucking essential. And Technical Ecstasy and this one, they've got some really interesting shit on, because they're one of those bands. They've been playing long enough. Whenever, like Lizzie, when they plug in and play, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
Why are they on Top of the Pops?
Well, when you sent me this episode out, I had no idea Sabbath were on it at all.
Yeah.
And it blew my fucking mind. Because I knew their 1970 appearance, wasn't it, for Paranoid, I think.
Yes.
But I had no idea that this even existed. It's a real mind blower from this period, because there's not a lot of live footage apart from when they go on tour with Van Halen and that sort of starts getting filmed. But it's amazing. It is amazing, isn't it, that they did it. That they thought...
Well, it's amazing that they were asked. Because there's no reason for Top of the Pops to get them on, because this song's not even come out yet. And it's amazing that they accepted.
Yeah.
You'd assume that, oh, they'd be like Led Zeppelin, don't bother with singles, or not doing Top of the Pops, it's beneath us. Are we going to get our Stonehenge in there?
I think it's possible that someone at the record company made an advance to Top of the Pops, because maybe they knew this album was going to be a hard push.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're like, you know, the prestige of having a serious rock band like Black Sabbath on your show could have come from that direction. I don't know.
Can't imagine Tony Blackburn pushing for it.
Well, no. You can see his reaction at the end, can't you?
Yeah.
So condescending.
I think this is a really good song. I was quite taken aback by it, and just gave me another prod to investigate Sabbath a bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always shunned them. But as a pop craze youngster of 1978, I would have looked at them and gone, oh, fucking hell, don't they know it's 1978? I mean, Ozzy's got one of Roger Daltrey's cast-offs with so much fucking fringing.
Yeah.
And when I watched this, my instant reaction was, Ozzy Osbourne is the dead spit in this episode of B. Smith. Yeah. Imagine if B. Smith was in a fucking metal band. How brilliant that would be. They'd call him Lagbasher. I'd wear a fucking Lagbasher t-shirt. And then I start, because it's lockdown, I start thinking about recasting Prisoner Soul Block H with pop icons. And I've got a list here.
Yeah.
And I've made a pretty decent sort. So, Ozzy Osbourne, B. Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The obvious one, Ian Brown, Lizzie Birdsworth. if you can't get him, Ronnie Wood.
Yeah.
Andy Scott of Sweet in his later years. Doreen Burns.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Rod Stewart, Margot Gaffney, David Sylvian, Chrissy Latham.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Fish, Judy Bryant.
Yeah.
Now, I need to cast some of the screws in Erica Davidson, but, you know, I think I've got the basis of a really solid pop star cast for Prisoner Cell Block H.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So any of the pop craze youngsters want to chip in on that? I mean, fucking hell, there's nothing else to do, is there? But yeah, I mean, this is great. This performance is great.
Yeah, well, someone should have told the audience, because they're not...
Exactly.
I mean, there's a few girls bopping like it's a disco tune.
Yeah, and gassing on about lads and shoes and what they read about in Jackie that week.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of lads on the right-hand side wearing Mickey Pierce hats.
Yeah, well, there's late 70s boys sulking. Because this is a bloody dinosaur band. There's one lad, he's got short hair, black leather bomber jacket, white trousers and pumps.
Yes,
like hands,
with his hands in his pockets, just fucking
defiantly deep in his pockets. Mm. He's point blank refusing to lift the sole of either shoe off the ground because the Clash wouldn't have approved.
He just ambles about, doesn't he? Like he's at a car boot sale or he's poking a worm with his shoe.
They should be ashamed of themselves. I don't think.
Yeah,
I forgive Ozzy everything. Do you know what I mean? I forgive him the fucking the Osbournes and all that sort of stuff because who wants to spend more than a decade with ghosts and demons howling around you? You know what I mean? And shooting up your throat every time you open your mouth to sing or drink. Yeah. You know, it's all he ever wanted was to be like the Beatles.
Yeah,
good for him.
So the following week, Never Say Die entered the charts at number 41, then soared 13 places to number 28, then dropped 3 places to number 31, but then jumped back up 10 places to number 21, which put them back on Top of the Pops again. And this time they were put in a dressing room next door to Bob Marley and the Wailers, who Ozzy claimed was brandishing the biggest spliff he'd ever seen in his life. And the band had to explain to the Wailers that Bill Ward hadn't put his hair into braids to take the piss out of them. That was just his look at the time. Can you imagine being witness to an argument between Black Sabbath and Bob Marley and the Wailers? Fucking hell. Some poor BBC commissioner's got to fucking break that up.
But I think, I mean, Sabbath ended up just being utterly astonished by the way Marley was able to smoke just a big fucking joint, but put in such an amazing performance when he actually come to do it, blew him away. Because we all know that we just make Sabbath cough, as you can hear at the beginning of Sweet Leaf. So, you know.
The follow-up, Hard Road, got to number 33 in October of this year, their last single before Ozzy Osbourne was sacked. Oh, man, it kills me to have to stop this part of episode 54 right here, but stop it I must, because we've still got a long way to go, and let me tell you, there are some very heavy hitters coming in the final part of this episode of Chart Music. So, let's all reassemble tomorrow. My name's Al Needham. On behalf of Taylor Parks and Neil Kulkarni, stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.
greatbigowl.com.
Hello, my darlings. It's me, Anna Mann, actress, singer, welder. Gotta have a backup. I've been in everything, my darlings, and I've been cut from most things. However, I will not be cut from one thing, and that is my own podcast, Talking to Actors with Anna Mann, where I meet those rarest of creatures, the actors. That's Talking to Actors on The Great Big Owl.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.